buddy.
What's up?
I go fishing in the dark today with Jeff Hanna on the Music Universe podcast. Oh my goodness, buddy. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I am great. I just got off the phone with a real legend of not just country music, but of all music. Jeff Hanna, founding member of Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yeah.
We had a fantastic conversation about the evolution of their music, what they're doing now, they're going back on the road, and their new album, which is out today, Dirt Does Dylan. And he talks about how much they love Bob Dylan and what that music means to them and the decision to go in the studio and record a cover album.
You know, that's interesting. I always wonder how people come up with cover albums. Now, this is another cover album because back in February of last year, I reported that they had one called The Times Are A-Changin'.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out at back in February, and it featured Roseanne Cash, Steve Earle, Jason Isbell, The War on Treaty. Did they talk about the comparisons of the two?
No, we just talked about their original catalog and Dylan and how much they love Dylan. And to that end, talking about the evolution of Nitty Gritty, Jeff said something. He said the winds shift. And so they as a band just sort of went where, not the trends, but where their inspiration took them. So it was, this guy is a really smart guy. Not only is he the founder, but you can tell he's kind of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band historian. It was a fantastic conversation with Jeff Hanna. Jeff Hanna of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, how are you today, sir?
I'm great, Matt. How you doing, buddy?
Oh, I am, well, I'm doing really great talking to a literal music legend right now. You know, it's your career, the career of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band has to be one of the most unique in American music history. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a handful of us. There are not many bands that have been around for over 50 years, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that we've kind of straddled different genres in our career, that's kind of unusual, I believe. So, yeah, I'm just glad that we're still here, you know, getting up on stage and playing for the folks every night.
And your music spans so many decades and so many sort of corners of music and country music. When you are putting the tour together, when you are putting your dates together, how do you guys decide what's going on the set list and what is going to sort of be left on the set list cutting room floor?
Well, I think we try to sort of play to the room, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course.
If we're playing like a country music festival or a fair, we might include more of the, you know, the mainstream country hits that we had in the 80s. And if we're playing, you know, a theater where it's literally like it's our choice, we tend to try to mix it up, you know. I mean, we certainly don't, we try not to eliminate stuff, you know. Obviously, you know, we got to do Fishing in the Dark and Mr. Bojangles every night. It's like, or you don't get to leave the building, one of those, you know, one of those deals. But yeah, I mean, and now we have a deep songbook. And so we try to, you know, reach back and grab stuff that we just might not have paid attention to much over the years, you know, and people request songs. And so there's this kind of a, you know, there's several things that play into that set list choice. Now, currently, because we have a new record that's coming out May 20th, mm-hmm. Of all Bob Dylan material, it's called Dirt Does Dylan. Wow. We're including a lot of that stuff, and it's so much fun to play, I got to tell you. It's so cool. We're huge Bob Dylan fans, and his music really fits our band like a glove. I'm really, really, you know, excited about laying some of those tunes on the folks. And the good news is they know a lot of these songs already. So the combination of our band and that material is seems to be working really well. We just started doing a bunch of these tunes on our last run a couple of weeks ago, and folks are responding in a really favorable fashion. So there you go. You know, it's, you know, we, again, you know, as a fan, when I go see somebody play, especially a veteran act that's been around for a while, you know, if they don't play, I got to expect that they might not play my two favorite songs, you know, but they'll play something I love. So,
right.
You know, and you got the case of like Bob Dylan, for example, that if you go see Bob Dylan, don't expect him to play anything from the 60s or 70s, because he's always moving forward, which is kind of great. But I know some folks have been disappointed that they didn't get to hear, you know, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, when they saw Bob play. But on the conversely, he's playing his whole new record on tour, which is really something, you know.
Right.
Amazing. He's an amazing artist. Really admire him.
What led to the decision to do a cover album of his music?
Well, it's interesting. We have this lineup has been together intact, I guess, is a good way to put it, since 2018. So we played 2018, 2019, and then, of course, everything stopped in 2020.
Right.
We played two shows in 2020, the first and last shows of the year, March 11th and 12th.
Wow.
And we had just started recording this record. The current lineup is myself, Jimmy Fadden, and the two of us have been playing together since day one back in the late 60s. Bob Carpenter, who came on board in 1980. So that's he's had a really good run with us. He's a great cat. So Bob and I and Jimmy, then our buddy Jim Photoglow, who incidentally co-wrote Fishing in the Dark, on bass. He came along in 2016. And then the puppies, I shouldn't use that word. They'd hate me for that. But the young guys, you know, my son, Jamie,
wow.
On guitar and vocals. And Jamie has had a really substantial career up until this point as well. Played with the Mavericks, one of my favorite bands also, with a great country singer named Gary Allen. Jamie came aboard and really, you know, obviously as his dad, I'm really grateful. And, you know, it fills my heart to be on stage playing with my son and singing. He's really good. And then Ross Holmes. Ross Holmes plays fiddle and mandolin for us. And he played with Mumford & Sons and also with Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers. Played a bunch with Ryan Bingham, the great singer-songwriter from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He's really great. I'm really glad to have him around, too. So those guys really were a real shot in the arm energy-wise for our band. And I was really, really, really happy to you know, kind of get this music out there. So when we put, I'm sorry, I'm making a longer story out of this than it needs to be. But we chose the Dylan thing. We thought, wouldn't it be great just to go in the studio instead of going through the usual A&R process where you're listening to each other's original material, which I love, by the way. But why not do something where we know that the song source is there and that we love it right now, you know? And we, you know, we thought about a couple of different writers, but Bob Dylan's music, I mean, we've been playing You Ain't Going Nowhere for many, many years that yeah. Bob wrote and the Birds originally recorded. We cut that on Will the Circle Be Unbroken Volume 2. So the Dylan, his songbook is so diverse that it really fit our band because we are, you know, kind of have a reputation as an eclectic band. You know, we play a lot of different styles of music. But and also we wanted to, you know, grab songs that, you know, that had a few that had big choruses like Quinn the Eskimo you know, Times Are a Changing and some others, you know, I Shall Be Released, that not all of his stuff has that. So that was a determining factor in terms of choosing the material. But I love all these songs. I mean, they're great. And look, the guy's got like 700 songs, I think. That's a round number. I'm not sure if that's accurate, but a ton. And they're all great. So we kind of put our hands into the hat. Sorry?
No, I say, yeah, I get it. There's such a deep well to choose from with him.
It was, yeah. But anyhow, you know, we're I'm very happy with the end result. Our buddy Ray Kennedy, who I co-produced this record with Ray, but he did most of the heavy lifting. I mean, he's a brilliant engineer. We cut it at his studio, Room and Board, here in Nashville, and he's done, you know, his resume. He's done a ton of Steve Earle albums and a bunch of Lucinda Williams records as well.
Wow.
He's got a new record by Beth Nielsen Chapman that's coming out this week, and you know, Billy Joe Shaver, just some crazy great artists that he's worked with. And he's a great guy, really, really good guy. We've become really close friends in the last couple of years. I've known him for many years, but mm-hmm. we'd never worked together. So that was fun. It was really fun working with him in the band. He's really super respectful of the guys in the band, and really a great cheerleader, you know,
yeah.
Which is an important element. A really great, you know, thing to have in your character as a record producer. He's a gem. He's a good one.
Love it. You know, and you said something in that story there about how you guys are an eclectic band and you play music from sort of all over. So I'm curious, looking back over 50 years of a career, it's such a broad question, but I've always wondered, how do you see the evolution of Nitty Gritty's music?
Well, you know, I always think that we're trying to, you know, everyone likes to believe that they're continuing to grow. You know, one of the reasons that we keep playing is that music is a living and breathing entity, you know. As far as the evolution goes, we started as a jug band, which is really a kind of a niche, kind of a thing. You know, it's a very specific thing, you know. Most of the music, all acoustic. You know, kitchen instruments like the washboard and the washtub bass, I guess those are more like laundry instruments. But, you know, mandolin, banjo, guitar, harmonica, sometimes fiddle, that sort of thing, you know. And we did that for the first couple of years that we were around, 66 till the end of 68. Towards the end of 68, we started sort of dabbling in what became California country rock. And I'm not talking about it's a tough genre to use, because now it means something very different than it did in LA in 69. In 69, it was more like bands like the Poco or the Flying Burrito Brothers, and eventually the Eagles. In the early days of the Eagles, they are definitely a country rock band. Take It Easy and Peaceful Easy Feeling, definitely that era.
Yeah.
So we actually, our band split up. We broke up for a few months. I went off and played in Linda Ronstadt's band. And when we got back together in the late spring, I think it was around June or July of 1969, we kind of had retooled our direction. That version of the Dirt Band is a lot like what we're doing now. I mean, it's, you know, and then with, of course, the string of hits in mainstream country radio in the 80s also is very reflective of what we've done. There's always been kind of a mountainy, bluegrass, old-timey country music aspect to what we do.
Yeah.
I mean, we all came individually out of folk music when we were kids. Everybody played the guitar, basically. Some of us played harmonicas eventually and added other string instruments along the way. But that's always informed what we do. And now with Americana as a genre, it's kind of like, well, that's home, you know, that's kind of where we live. It's a funny thing. And I like to point this out. During the mid 80s till the late 80s, in mainstream country radio, you had acts like Roseanne Cash and Steve Earle and Lyle Lovett and Ricky Skaggs, you know, to name a few, who are now really mainstays in Americana. So I think as a point of you know, of reference, that also gives you an idea. What we were doing was, you know, I think some of those records, like Longhard, Rodney Crowell's another one. Longhard Rhoda, I was going to say, is a record that a tune that Rodney wrote that we had a number one record in at country radio, and that's like It's an Americana tune.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, there's the winds shift, you know, and change happens. And I'm all for that, by the way. There's lots of country artists that I really admire right now. Miranda Lambert comes to mind immediately. Keith Urban, Brothers Osborne, love them.
Yeah.
You know, I think that where we live is probably more, if you got to use a genre, I think the big umbrella of Americana probably makes the most sense.
Yeah, that's incredible. I can tell you think quite a bit about how you have evolved over the years. Now, I just learned in reading up for this interview, and I got to know the story behind this, that not only were you the Tutankhamun's behind Steve Martin at SNL,
yeah.
You're also...
No, no, actually, I gotta correct you on that just for a second.
Yeah.
We didn't do it on SNL. We were on the road and couldn't back Steve up on SNL. So we weren't the guys, you know, in the Egyptian costumes.
Oh, wow.
No. But we are actually a couple of us. Me, I played guitar and sang, and our rhythm section at the time, Merle Bregani and Richard Hathaway, it was the three of us and Steve. Cut that record. It was supposed to be a demo. We recorded that in Bill McEwen's studio. Bill was our manager and managed Steve as well. And we cut that record in Aspen, Colorado.
Yes. So how did that come about? How'd you end up working with Steve Martin, of all people?
We've known Steve forever. In fact, our former banjo player, John McEwen, went to high school with Steve,
Cool.
And I think he really, Steve credits John with teaching him how to play the banjo. And Steve is a very good student. He's a great banjo player now. But so Steve was our opening act for a long time. And then when he hit it big, we were doing a show. I think it was a dirt band concert. In Los Angeles at, I think it was the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. And Steve came backstage and said, I'd like to sit in with you guys on the encore. And we're like, great, come on up and we'll play, you know, Foggy Mountain Breakdown or something. And he goes, no, I'm writing this song. And we literally just kind of improvised something and went out, and he kind of did this sort of rap, for lack of a, and you know, kind of recited, you know, when I was a young boy, I never thought I'd see, you know. A few weeks later, when we were all in Colorado, again, Steve and I and Merle and Richard showed up in the studio and kind of refined the form of the song, rearranged it a bit, and came up with that record. It was really fun. It was really fun that the four of us sang background vocals on it. I played lead guitar. And our friend Brian Savage, who's a great, great saxophone player, played sax on that as well. But that was intended to be a demo for Bill McEwen to take to the, you know, the higher ups at Warner Brothers Records in LA. They heard it and went, why would we re-record this? This is perfect. So that's hilarious. It's the only gold single I have hanging in my house is King Tut.
You never know what's going to hit, right?
It's funny. It's hilarious. And Steve's such a great cat, man. I really love him. I admire him a lot. I love his writing. He really is. Mm-hmm. I've read all of his books as well, and he's just terrific.
It's amazing. So what did you guys do during the year and a half off, other than the Dylan record? Any original music coming out?
Well, we're always writing, you know, and that's, you know, on the back burner right now, because we're going to be going out and, you know, and playing the Dylan stuff for now. But yeah, I mean, that's always part of the process. We got a nice collection of tunes in our pocket, let's say. But during that year and a half, I mean, during 2020, we didn't do it. I mean, we were all hunkered down, honestly.
Right.
You know, Bob Carpenter lives in Los Angeles. Jimmy Fadden lives in Florida. And I didn't see those guys from March of 2020 till August 21.
Wow.
Yep. And at that point, they came to Nashville and we recorded the final two tracks for the Dylan album, you know, and hopped on the bus August, I think it was around the 15th of August. and went out and played 37 shows in about 2 months, 2.5 months, which was like, that's a lot of work. But we were so excited to be playing in front of a live audience again that we were, that kind of warmed us up for what we're doing this year.
Yeah, I'm excited. I see there are some dates on your website now, but are more dates going to come out as things go, as the year progresses?
Oh, absolutely. You know, good. I think we'll end up doing, 65, 70 days this year. When we were kids, we were out on the road for in the triple digits, 100 to 150, sometimes 200 shows. But if we want to keep doing this, we can't do that much every year. we got to pace ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm excited to see you in Lancaster, which will have happened by the time this airs to promote the Dylan album.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate that.
I'm excited to see that show, and I'm just so glad a legendary band like you guys are back out there on the road. It's a sign that we're getting back to normal and music is coming back.
I totally agree with you, man. It's great. And again, I know anybody that hasn't been to a live show in a while, it's like, it's such a gift. It matters more than ever right now. And I'm really grateful that we get to do that.
Right. Well, Jeff Hanna, this was a treat. Thank you so much. Again, looking forward to a week or so from now when I get to sit down and sing Fishing in the Dark and Mr. Bojangles with you guys. Looking forward to it.
There you go, buddy. Have a great weekend, man. See you
too. Take care.
Bye.
Fishing in the Dark, man. It's become a Garth concert staple, but I love that song long before he was performing it. It's just a classic song that is a great country song.
Well, Fishing in the Dark, yes, but how about that about King Tut and Steve Martin and the fact that they recorded King Tut for him and it was a demo, as Jeff told us, but the record company said, no, this is perfect. So Jeff Hanna plays on Steve Martin's iconic King Tut record, and he said it's the only gold record he has hanging in his house. So
That amazes me. So was Fishing in the Dark not the big seller?
I didn't ask that. I don't know if it went platinum or not, but I don't quite know what Jeff meant by that, and I didn't want to ask because I didn't want to seem ignorant and stupid. But you would think it's one of those songs where it's like, scratches your head that it didn't sell well because the music, it's the song itself is so pervasive. So I think it might be, it might be sort of the cult movie of songs, doing what cult movies do, where it doesn't really sell a lot or move the needle when it comes out, but over time just becomes one of the most beloved songs of all time.
Apparently, if Wikipedia is to believe, because, I sit in front of my computer all day, and where else is a better place to record a podcast episode than with information right in front of me? It was certified platinum by the Recording Industry Association of America in September of 2014. So there we go. They have a platinum record with it. And it was a number one hit. Can you believe it was released in June of 87?
Wow.
It's that old. It's classic.
45 years.
It's timeless, though. It's a timeless classic. How old?
That's 45 years.
No, it's not. 87.
Oh.
Hey, I'm a few years older than that, so don't even go there. Don't even age me that quickly.
That's right. So 35 years. There we go.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
I failed math.
Well,
don't worry about me.
60, 70 dates is a lot these days for any act. You know, used to be 200 dates that were considered, a long tour.
We have a crowded field now
of
everybody trying to make up for the tours that were canceled the last 2 years. I don't think probably 25, 26, those dates will all be satisfied, and maybe even by 24. And the pressure will be off on the venues, but we'll see. But I think that's why, you're seeing less tours. It's not just because these bands are aging, but depending upon who you want to go see, if Taylor Swift normally does 100 dates, maybe she's only doing 60 because of venue availability.
Yeah, well, you never know. I mean, there's a lot of tour announcements coming in, it seems like, daily. People are getting back out there. I'd say we're back, even though apparently yep. cases are rising, but I think it's just going to be the way it's going to be forever now, and we're just going to deal with it.
And venue availability is why I'm going to Massachusetts. Well, because Garth answered my question on Studio G that said he's not going to do anything in New York. So that told me that this is... See, what's interesting is the press release has said a couple of different things. The press release that you get said last New England dates. Okay?
Mm-hmm, right.
And then he's talking about how Charlotte and Foxborough kind of make up for the rest of the north part of the East Coast, which maybe we'll get Philadelphia, maybe, but he said one day Studio G, so it's coming from his mouth, but it's kind of unofficial because what he says and what gets released on a press release are sometimes two different things.
Right.
So he said that kind of takes care of the Northeast, which means no Garth in New York, no Garth in Philly, so no Garth in sort of my home territory. We had Baltimore. That was one where they lost the stadium and couldn't get it back to make up for it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to Foxborough, and I have very, very, very pissed off parents.
Wait, so your dad's mad too?
My dad does not want to take me to the airport. Because I'm flying in. I'm flying from Nashville back home. I'm going to Nashville again too, which we've talked about on the show. I'm running to Nashville for a couple of days. Then I'm flying home to Pennsylvania. And then I'm coming back. And then I'm going to Foxborough for three nights.
So how long are you going to be gone on this leg of your trip?
This is another two-weeker for me. Didn't mean for it to be, but here we go. So
you just can't help yourself.
My mother's like, why do you need to? You need to give up the ghost. Garth is married, man. It's never going to happen. And I'm like, look, he's not going to tour for the next couple of years. He wants to do these residencies. I'm not going to go to every single residency. I'm not going to drop $300. I'm laughing at myself as I say it because I don't know how much I believe it. But
right,
I'm. It's less reasonably priced for the acoustic shows, so I don't plan to be in Vegas every time that he's out there. I think we'll go to one, or I'll go to one of the Nashville ones, just to say that I did that. But in terms of seeing him in the arena, in the stadium setting, or in the full band setting, I should say, rather, I would have done New York. I was holding out for a New York or a Baltimore or a Philly, but all evidence points that Foxborough was sort of the last northeast stop, and then I'm taking my friend Isaac to Charlotte, and then I'm doing the second Charlotte show, and then that means that officially, when we do Ireland, that will be show number 20 for me. And then I don't mind if he retreats for a couple of years into acoustic shows, because I will have seen him plenty of times.
Well, I'll tell
you. Not that I haven't already.
Exactly. Well, you know, I
dare you to catch up to me.
No, because that's the problem. For a while, I was like, okay, I'm just a few behind. And then suddenly you start trekking across the country, doing multiple shows. And, you know, Nashville came... It blindsided me. I was not
Nashville
expecting
that. Nashville was a when in Rome. Well, I'm going to be there for three.
No, I 100%. Hey, I even told you we're going to the shows if we're going to be there.
Yeah.
I even told you before I was involved. Dude, you got to stick around. I mean, I was encouraging you, even though I wanted to catch up. I'm like, you got to stick around. It's pointless to leave 2 days before.
And the weather was beautiful. Oh, it all worked out.
That, and of course, we did the press conference. He was on here a couple weeks ago because of it. So all a win-win. I only thing is, I don't know that I would do the Vegas show again just because of the price and the fact that
He did say that it was platinum because they were testing it out, but if it becomes a solidified residency, it'll be hard, immovable tickets, which is the good thing, because right. among the community of, so Saturday is still sold out, I think, or they opened it up and it's only 200 sections. I have a friend who's selling me a really good seat, and the Garth community, I will say this about the fans, they know, because he does single price for all seats, they know they can't, if you're in the know, they can't gouge you, right. you know. So, not that they would, because Garth fans are nice people, but I think maybe we, you know, on a $98 ticket, we charge $100 to make it even, you know. And,
I mean, that's fair. You're $2, yeah, that's a handling fee.
yeah. So, and my friend, get this, Mr. Physical Tickets. She says that her ticket is a physical ticket, and she can mail it.
So she must have paid the extra for the right. physical.
I told her, I don't want it to get lost in the mail. I'm going to be traveling to Nashville, etc. I said, I don't want it to get lost in the mail. Just hold on to it, and I will buy it from you in person. You know, I will... You can give it to me. And I asked her, I said, do you want your money now or do you want it there? And she said, if you promise to buy it, you can pay me at the show. So shout out to Amy. Thank you very much.
So she just has an extra ticket then, and you're going to take it?
Yes, for Saturday.
Okay. So, because I know that we met her in San Diego and Jim, and they go to like every show, it seems.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they're cool people. I love them. Harriet. Hi, Harriet. If you're listening, I will finally get to hug your neck. I cannot wait to see some friends. And that's part of why I want to go. The New Yorkers are all going to this one. So yeah. I get to see them. I'm so excited.
That makes sense. And I'll stay in Bakersfield. I've got enough stuff going on. I don't need to be traveling more.
No, I'm not going to nag you about this one. I'm just going to lord that number 20 over your head.
But, you know, that doesn't bother me, because I still have so many more shows up over you on Reba, and that will continue. So that's the thing. That's the thing that's got me really nervous right now, and we spoke about this off air, is I know more dates are coming from her. I just hope they're not when we're gone and that she's closer to me.
I'm going to say July and August. I'm going to say July and August and September, maybe some September, but I'm going to guess that we'll get an announcement this month for a late summer tour.
That or fall, but, you know, she's right. working on her Reba's Place in Oklahoma, so that may be the focus, but I do know 2022-23 dates are coming. It's just a matter of when and where. And Bakersfield is not a place she really plays, but just being close enough that I can drive and, you know, drop some dough, obviously, on two VIP tickets, because I got a kid that's going to want to tag along on that. It's just gut-wrenching altogether, because right. I can already feel it. But see, that's why I won't yeah. necessarily travel yeah. like you do to see her, because I'll want the VIP all the time. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, a lot of tours, I mean, everybody's on tour or has announced a tour.
My one thing, because I'm trying to do a comprehensive run this year of shows, I will admit,
really,
talk about big tours, that one that's on my list is Justin Bieber. Grew up with him being the sensation. He's settled down. He's married. Doesn't pee in buckets anymore. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what an older, I mean, God, he's my age, but what an older, less of the moment Justin Bieber.
Less obnoxious Justin Bieber.
Right, right.
Because we all know about we all know about the whole arrest and all that obnoxiousness about it, almost a decade ago, I guess.
Was he ever arrested? I don't know about that.
Yeah, he was a slew of stupid stuff as a teenager, and then it caught up to him.
This is a topic for, if I do get in, we should do a podcast on this. This is a topic for that. You know, how much of that is he's just a shithead, and how much of that is the immense pressure of fame at 14 years old? You're discovered on YouTube. Usher takes you under your wing, and suddenly you're playing arenas to screaming fans.
Oh, yeah.
like the Beatles. I mean, and you can't be a kid anymore. Suddenly you're a 14-year-old with the enough money to buy your own villa.
Well, and it's also, I mean, you know, you got influences like never before on these things. So
what is open to you and what is offered to you and what is available to you as a rock star, no matter the ages, are certain temptations.
And
so,
him, you know, him having fun, you know, I know he caused a lot of problems at his house when he, you know, he had a place at the Elusive Oaks out in Calabasas, you know, where the Kardashians live and a lot of people. He caused a lot of problems there. And that's what I was alluding to. And then some racing thing, I believe, I don't even remember. And Florida, I think, is what really caught up to him. But, you know, you live and you learn. You just got to move on.
And the other one is Lady Gaga. The other one, she stayed out of trouble, but I was never, I'll say what Garth says. I'm the squarest person on the planet.
That is true.
I never really was into Gaga when Gaga was the thing, but now, and she was wearing her meat dresses and being a weirdo, but now that she's matured and is now what they consider a legacy artist because she has so many hits, even at her age, and she's not even out of her mid-30s yet, and she's an incredibly talented actress, although somebody told her a Russian accent for House of Gucci and not an Italian accent. I've grown to respect her. Her respect for the legends like Tony Bennett and Liza Minnelli and her sort of recent classiness and classing up of herself. You know, it's really interesting to see how these attention-seeking acts from when I was in high school have grown up. It's just a fascinating... I'm on a tangent now, but it's fascinating. So all of that to say that there are a lot of shows coming up, a lot of tours, like you were saying. Everybody's getting back out on the road, and it's just so cool to see.
Yeah, I know. By the time this airs, would have seen Eric Church and twice, a second time, if you can believe it.
Hey, I offered.
Well, no. Not the point. But it's all right. That's what the kid likes doing, except all those damn tickets are the platinum. So, you know, you got to deal with it, I guess. But and it's great because this time I was able to secure the wand that she wanted before.
Okay, before we raise eyebrows with that, you have to explain what the wand is.
Well, if I knew what it was, I would.
You know what it is.
Well, yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's a wand that these K-pop artists tend to, I guess,
it lights up.
Encourage
it lights up.
You to bring and buy at their concerts if you can find them at the concerts, and it lights up. Sometimes they can be controlled, sometimes they can't, or they're not being controlled. I guess I don't know if that depends on localities or whatever, but in LA, I don't believe they were controlled the first time. And they light up, and they have bracelets, too. But one thing I didn't know, and I didn't tell her this whenever I bought it, and we were in Nashville when I bought this, actually, because the concert was, you know, coming up, and they had them in stock at the K-pop Vegas store. Well, they didn't have them in stock, but they were taking pre-orders for the new stock. I ordered her a special edition bracelet, not knowing that the wand actually comes with a standard bracelet.
Interesting.
And I found that out when I called to check on the order status, because I was like, you know, this thing, you know, I need to know if it's going to be there. And I just had to place the order initially because they didn't answer whenever I had tried to call them. But they have weird hours. They're only open from like 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. or something like that. It's really weird hours. But next time we're in Vegas, I told her I would take her. Didn't get to the last couple times we were there just because it's off strip and our focus usually is there or taking you to Boot Barn.
All right, for the Music Universe podcast, I'm Matt.
And I'm Buddy. Thanks for listening. And keep checking out themusicuniverse.com and check us out at tmupod.com, where you can like, subscribe, and share us on socials at The Music Uni. Take care.